How is it initiated to take what is a successful and a big name print title to digital only?
Our brands need to be where our audiences expect our brands to be. Vogue was not yet producing content, but there was a ton of Vogue content on TikTok because audiences were creating it themselves and posting it. A lot of companies make a mistake of saying, this is the activity that's best for our business. Our brands sit at the center of what we do, and we create an ecosystem of opportunities to engage with audiences or advertisers. You have to start at, what does our audience want? What is our audience telling us? And then figure out how to build a business model around it.
Roger, thank you for being here with me today. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
So I want to talk to you, CEO of Condé Nast. Now, one of the stories that I saw, you're the global CEO, but it doesn't say that in your title. It just says CEO. And that is pretty much all encompassing of what it is that you're doing now.
Yes. I think prior to my joining, the company was really split in two. There was a US business, which had a CEO, and there was everything outside of the US. It was run completely independently and had a CEO based in London. So when I joined, those two stepped aside, and then I began a process of merging the company so that we could operate as a global company.
And walk me through one or two of the biggest challenges that you faced.
Well, I think, you know, the industry was facing challenges that, you know, broadly, it varies market by market, and we're in many, many markets around the world, but print subscriptions, print advertising were declining, but there was an opportunity to grow in other new areas that we had to develop. A lot of it we had to develop. So we had that sort of industry overlay on top of what was a company that was really organized. You know, the company's over 100 years old, and it was still organized like a print company. So every country where we operated completely independently from every other country. There was no sharing of content or technology or insights or even creating sort of brand guidelines. It was all independent. And then within each country, every brand operated completely independently, which meant that the sales teams, for instance, for Vogue would be different than the sales teams for GQ and would in effect compete with each other. And so what I was not from this industry, so I sort of had an outsider's view, and I just looked at it and said, okay, if I were starting this company today, what would be a structure that would make sense to me? Knowing that the growth is going to be in digital areas. And so we embarked on a multi-year process to really, you know, really to the core of the company, change how we operate, how we're structured, how we share content, how we share information, technology. And that was, you know, that was as much an organizational change, it was even more a cultural change.
So I'm a big fan of promoting the local content that the different publishers produce. And in a previous life, I worked at a magazine publishing house here. And I believe that there will be lots of opportunities for the local team to take content from some of the international brands. But I wonder, will the international brands feel comfortable, or will they be encouraged to take stuff from what the Dubai team produces?
It's core to how we work today. And that was, you know, again, when I joined and I would go around and I meet with some of our editorial teams around the world, I heard a similar story from each one of them, which is, you know, our audiences in fill in the blank, whatever country, Italy, France, you know, Taiwan, didn't matter, are only interested in content produced locally here. They would all say the same thing. And I would say, well, you know, let's look at the data. Let's look at what the traffic to your websites, but also how audiences in your country are accessing our titles around the world. And in almost every country, you'd see 35 to 40% of the audience was coming from outside of the market, and 35 to 40% of their audience was going to other titles outside of their market. And so we just tell them, like, if you look at what the audiences are telling us, they're telling us something completely different. They're interested in the content from around the world. We're just not organized in a way to present that effectively. And we're also, you know, if you look at, like, our biggest title is Vogue. Vogue has a lot of influence around the world. And I really felt like we were squandering it by never having an ability to have Vogue as a brand globally get behind an initiative, because there was no global Vogue. Everything was independent in every country.
So you're out here for the big reveal for what's going to be happening for Vogue Arabia and for GQ Middle East. Can you tell me, from a strategic point of view, what you see Dubai and the UAE and the GCC doing for both brands?
First of all, it's a region that I've been interested in for a long time. I first came to Dubai almost 25 years ago. I've done business in the region. I used to, in a previous company I started years ago, I would bring content from the Middle East into the U.S. and serving to the diaspora there. So it's always been a region I've been interested in. It's also for our categories. Our biggest categories are luxury, fashion, travel, beauty, a very fast growing region. And, you know, I felt like it was, you know, when we were operating through licensees here, we weren't seeing the growth that really represented the opportunity in the region. You know, if you take our biggest brand, Vogue, globally, Vogue has grown every year in the last 4 years. And, you know, we weren't seeing the same benefits in this region, principally because most of that growth has come through innovation in creating new digital products or e-commerce or events or things like that. It was, you know, it's not from the traditional business. And we felt like we really needed to see the growth match the opportunity here. And we felt the best way to do that was to own and operate our brands directly.
Now, in doing that, though, there's been a little bit of pushback from at least one of the local publishers. What can you tell me about where that situation stands now?
Well, like, we appreciate our licensees, and we have many licensees that we work with around the world that have helped build businesses. I can't comment specifically because of confidentiality agreements about that. But what I can say is that, you know, our license has expired with our licensees, and we're launching them under our own and operated business here in Dubai.
One of the issues that I'm familiar with, having been and continuing to be a journalist, do you think, and maybe it's not something that you're too concerned about, but there's going to be pushback from some of the other brands when it comes to maybe taking content from this part of the world because of some of the day-to-day issues that people here live with, but people in the West are not always comfortable seeing.
But that's part of the opportunity. That's part of what makes this really interesting to me. And we're already seeing it, you know, because we launched AD and Condé Nast Traveler 18 months ago in the region when those licenses expired earlier than the Vogue and GQ licenses. And we're already seeing interest from the other Condé Nast Traveler and AD publications around the world in content from this region. And I think it's only, you know, the region, you know, you've lived here many years. The region is changing, and it changes at a rate that far surpasses anywhere else. You have more established, you know, Europe, US, there are changes that happen, but not at the rate that happens here. And I think that's part of the opportunity, is to help educate, you know, our readers everywhere around the world about the opportunities in this region, whether it's fashion, architecture, tourism.
Now, I saw an interview that you conducted about 5 years ago where you said that one of the reasons you took the Condé Nast job is because you like to solve problems. So you said now that you think this is an opportunity. Do you see any problems with it fitting with the brand, the local brands fitting into the global brand that is Condé Nast?
You know, because we've already operated in the region with licensees, you know, our licensees we work closely with, and we review content. We review changes in editors, and you know, we have a very close relationship with licensees around the world. So it's not like we're new to the region or new to working with content produced in the region. With all new launches, you have to expect some bumps along the road, but we have a really strong team here and a very experienced team. All of our editors have many years of experience leading publications in the region and in some cases around the world. And the same for our managing director and our sales teams here. So it's not like we're starting from scratch. We have a very good, experienced team.
One of the issues that I get asked an awful lot about when I travel back home is censorship. So I'll spin it a little bit. Will there be sort of a global oversight editorial board that looks at what is going on here to say that's not strong enough, or you need to be a little bit more hard-hitting with something? or is it more of a true partnership?
You know, we have, the way we're organized now with our editorial teams is each of our global brands has a global editorial director. And that person, so in the case of Vogue, that's Anna Wintour. That person is responsible for globally all of the content that is produced. But it is pretty decentralized in that we still have in every market, most of the content that is produced or that is published is locally produced content. And so we make sure, just like, you know, in my role, I see my role related to editorial is choosing who the editors are. After that, I step back. It really is up to the editors, and we feel very much the same way in the local markets. That doesn't mean they don't get coaching and help, but there's a lot of responsibility that's given to our local editorial teams.
Yeah, that's something similar to what I do with my team. You hire good people, and then, you know, you say, how can I help? And you get out of the way. But getting back to your situation, you as an undergrad, you studied physics.
I did.
And now you're in media. How did that journey take place? And at any point, was the family disappointed, surprised, pleased with the change of course?
I think their big surprise is that I even went to college and studied physics. Because before that, my plan, I've been a musician all my life, was just to follow that route. And going to college ended up being a last-minute decision for me, and it was a good decision, it turns out. But, I studied physics in college because I actually took my first physics class when I was in college and just fell in love with it. And so it changed my major, and that became my focus. I worked as a researcher after college and found that I enjoyed studying physics more than I did being a researcher, especially the stuff I was doing, defense industry R&D, and I worked in an underground lab by myself, and it was just a bit lonely. And so I ended up going back to business school, and then using the technology background I have, I became an investment banker in Silicon Valley in the mid to late 90s when the heyday was going on and we were taking all these companies public, and moved to London to do that. And then I started starting internet companies in the late, I think 1999 was the first one. And I've mostly been an entrepreneur. So Condé Nast and the company before I ran, Pandora, were the first companies that I ran that I didn't start. But there are three other companies that I had started prior to that.
No pushback from the family, from your wife? Everybody was cool with...
My wife and I, we met in university in senior year, and we got married right after graduation. So we got married very young and started having kids. And she's been a champ the whole way because we've moved and lived all around the world. And she's seen me take new jobs, and she's been nothing but encouraging.
That's fantastic. So let me ask you another question about the work environment, how you sort of manage your team. Allure was a magazine that was incredibly successful for you guys, and then you decided to go from print to digital only, which I think is a conversation a lot of publishers are having. I saw recently that I think it was last year or within the past 18 months, the New York Times finally had more digital subscribers than paper subscribers. So how does the conversation, how is it initiated to take what is a successful and a big name print title to digital only?
Yeah. I mean, there've been a number of titles in our portfolio that have gone through that transition. And in most cases, they end up more successful as a digital title, but it's specific to the title. So there are brands that I think because of what they cover, the nature of what they do, are best represented as digital brands. And there are other brands where I imagine print being a core of what they do for a very, very long time. That doesn't mean that print will be the majority of the revenue or the engagement with audiences. But if you take Vogue again, our biggest brand, the print cover of Vogue is a cornerstone of what Vogue does. It's a cultural moment. It creates, and in, when we shoot a cover, we create all this other content too, whether it's a podcast, video.
Behind the scenes stuff.
Yes, yeah. And it becomes a part of an ecosystem. And that's where we've seen, like I mentioned, Vogue, our biggest brand has grown every year in the last 4 years. But that's come from creating new innovation around a core strategy that we have, which is our brands sit at the center of what we do, and we create an ecosystem of opportunities to engage with audiences or advertisers around that brand. And Vogue, I think, has been the, you know, the best example of that. So whether it's events like Vogue World, which we created 3 years ago, which has become a huge event for us, which ties into the cover of Vogue, ties into what we do on e-commerce, video. It really feeds an ecosystem. So I think for a brand like Vogue, you know, print is going to remain a really core element to it, not because it's the biggest or it gets the most engagement, but because it does still sit as the cornerstone of what we do.
When you talk about the ecosystem, one of the challenges that I know as an editor I face, back in the day we used to have social media, and the challenge was, how do we get them to go from Facebook to our website? Now I sort of see that people who follow us on TikTok, that's how they get their content from us. Some maybe only come to the website, ideally 3 or 4 times a day. And there are probably some who are still, well, of course, I know that there are some who still want their news in the paper format. Do you see all of those different followers for all the Condé Nast brands as separate readers, or is it a collection and then they are consuming content across everything?
You know, the audiences on the platforms can be different. You know, our audiences on TikTok are, you know, there's certainly some overlap, but will be somewhat different than the audiences on Facebook or than who read the print magazine. But we start with a core belief, which is that our brands need to be where our audiences expect our brands to be. And so TikTok's a good example. When TikTok launched in the US, Vogue was not yet producing content, but there was a ton of Vogue content on TikTok because audiences were creating it themselves and posting it. And so they were telling us, we want Vogue to be on TikTok. And we launched Vogue and it became very successful. Now, we didn't really have an idea about how or whether we'd be able to make money off of that. But the history of the internet is you get engagement first and then monetization follows. And we felt it was really important to be where our audiences expected us to be and to build that engagement. And we'll worry about the business side opportunities later.
It's funny, I agree with you. And I think there's almost an approach where it's like, we have to do it and then we have to figure out, almost reverse engineering, how are we going to generate an income or how are we going to generate profits from it? Because back in the day, you know, the only form of interaction that really took place in my industry, newspapers and readers, would have been letters, mm-hmm. right. know, to the editor.
Sure.
And now, of course, I kind of feel like we have to listen to what they want and then follow their trends. So the same for us, for TikTok and all the other social media platforms. For us, in this part of the world, WhatsApp channel is mm-hmm. is big.
Sure.
And so we saw that was an opportunity. So we followed what the trend is, what our consumers and our readers are doing. And that way, if we were able to generate content that was appropriate for it, it would turn out to be successful. We still haven't quite cracked that nut about how we can generate revenue. And that, I think, has to be a big challenge for you as well.
Yes, but, you know, like in TikTok, as I mentioned, you know, we launched before we had any idea of whether there'd be any way to drive revenue from it. But we worked with them, and we were a launch partner with them with something called Pulse Premier, which was really an ad product our teams were able to sell ads around our our content. And they launched with a few other partners, but we immediately sold out of all the ad inventory. And so, you know, we were fortunate that we were able to work with them to create an opportunity like that. But it's, you know, you have a choice. Do you listen to your audiences, or do you follow what you think is best for your business? And I think a lot of companies make a mistake of saying, this is the activity that's best for our business. If we want our audiences to do XYZ, and if they do that, we're going to have a successful business. And the problem with that is you're starting at the wrong starting point. You have to start at, what does our audience want? What is our audience telling us? And then figure out how to build a business model around it. Now, the problem with that is the business models that you may be able to build around it may not be as good as the business model it's replacing. If you look at the music industry, that's a great example. CD sales peaked in 1999. Then people started downloading music. The music industry said, well, we don't like that behavior. We're going to stop them. We're going to get them to stop downloading and buy CDs again, because that's what's good for our business. So they, in the US, there were these lawsuits against teenagers, and they tried to get the ISPs to block it all. And the industry almost went bankrupt doing this, until finally they started to embrace digital. So here we are, what, 26 years later almost? The recorded music industry is still not quite as big as it was in 1999. But it's growing and it's healthy. The new business model of streaming is not as good as the business model of selling CDs, but it's the one that's available to you. And so, and the music industry, I think, learned a lesson by not listening to audiences and trying to change behavior to what fit their business model, as opposed to saying, okay, that's the behavior, that's what's going to happen. How do I create a business model around that?
And I think it's also good leadership practice, which is to be a little bit more humble and to maybe listen to outside voices. Instead of saying, this is what I want to do and this is how I'm going to do it, I think people have to be willing to listen to the people around them, as well as much younger people who will come up with great ideas. But you're talking about technology, and it's obviously with DeepSeek being a big issue right now. You, Condé Nast, signed a deal with OpenAI. How did that come about, and how is that going?
Yeah. Well, when OpenAI first launched ChatGPT, it was pretty revolutionary. I mean, caught the whole world by surprise. And we immediately recognized that it was going to create opportunities, but also threats. The way these models learn is by ingesting content that is produced by others. And we felt very strongly that that we needed to protect our intellectual property rights, but also that if we use AI, we need to do it in a way that we're not infringing other people's intellectual property rights. So within a few months, we published AI guidelines globally for our editorial teams that said, this is the way we'll use AI, but even more importantly, this is the way we'll not use it, because we didn't, you know, we wanted to be principled about this. Today, we have over 60 projects that are either launched already or in development that use generative AI. As you mentioned, we came to an agreement with OpenAI, and we're very pleased with that, because we do believe that these AI companies should be licensing the content from the publishers and others where they're using this content to train and also to retrieve information from. And those license deals, yeah, there's a financial side to it, but equally importantly, there is the conditions that are put around how that content could be used. And so just like in, other businesses I run, whether it's in film and television or, music, the license deals have an economic angle to it, but they also have here are the rights that are granted, which say you can do this, but you can't do these things over here. And that's what will give publishers control over how their content is used and distributed.
So you've also talked in the past about how Google and Facebook take too much money from us as publishers. You still feel that way?
Look, if you look at what has happened to digital advertising, almost all of the growth goes to a small number of big tech platforms, whereas almost all of the content that is produced not by big tech platforms. So we're always interested in making sure that we get a balance right where we can develop healthy business models around producing digital content and distributing digital content and advertising. So, yes.
A long-winded way of saying, yes, I agree. And I also, workplace values mean a lot at Condé Nast. You've got a fair bit of talk about it on your website. It's 2025. I think we know what's happened this month. Do you feel that there'll be any backlash to have to shift the way that you hire and the sorts of stories that you want your team to cover?
I tell our teams that if you're a company and you have values, the way you know that they're values is by how you adhere to them when the winds are going against you. Because if you just throw them out the window and say, hey, here are our new values, they were never values. They were conveniences. And so for us, they're core values of the company. Now, lots of companies you see making changes now. They're dumping their DEI programs. They're erasing things from their website. We're doubling down on it. We just hired a brand new head of DEI this past month. And we report on those. We have goals. We do an annual report. That's going to continue. It's a core value of who we are. And other companies will make their own decisions. But we know very firmly where we stand on these issues.
So this, I'm not sure if you know this or not, but this is what would be the 30th anniversary since the launch of George. And George, I think, looked spectacular back when JFK Jr. was running it. Considering the climate today, and because of the way it looked in that first photograph with Cindy Crawford, shot by Herberts, I think, do you think that a title like George would do well in 2025?
You know, every title has to ideally have core values that really underpin its mission, but has to change. If you look at, you know, the New Yorker is now celebrating its 100th anniversary, February this year. You know, the New Yorker, you know, we went back and looked at the original charter for the New Yorker. It aligns very, very directly with what we do today. But I'm sure that if you looked at, you know, the original team that launched the New Yorker, if they looked at the New Yorker today, it would be almost unrecognizable because, you know, things have moved on. What it, you know, the obviously how we produce content, how we distribute content has changed. So, you know, when you're in an industry like ours that there's so much changing. Technology, obviously a big factor, but even audiences. The certain mistake you can make is to not change. If you don't change, you are definitely making a mistake. 100% certain. So you have to be willing to change. Now, when you make changes, some of them work, some of them don't. You make mistakes. But the good thing about it is you realize that you get feedback quickly and you can adjust. If you make no changes, you get no feedback other than you see a slow decline of your business that ultimately leaves you irrelevant or out of business. So that's a mistake we don't intend to make.
Do you, because you look after part of the, Condé Nast has some of the biggest global fashion brands. Do you feel any pressure to dress a certain way when you go into the office?
Ah, yeah, good question. You know, we have a pretty casual office. You know, it does not feel like, we have a lot of young people that work at Condé Nast. So I'd say it feels pretty informal in the office to me. And I feel the same way about how I dress her.
But you don't have to worry. In your mind, when you're getting up and you're looking in the closet, you're not thinking, okay, this is my style or my look for today.
I think about what I'm doing that day. You know, do I have outside meetings? Am I meeting with, you know, a politician or, you know, government official or whatever, and I'll dress appropriately for that occasion. If not, you know, you'll probably see me in jeans and, you know, a jacket, but it'll be more casual.
Earlier you talked about playing music all your life. Mm-hmm. What instrument do you play?
I play guitar.
Okay. So, first concert you ever went to?
It was Van Halen. And that was one of the big, inspirations for me in playing guitar. I'd already started learning to play guitar, but
this would have been what year?
Oh my gosh. This would have been, in the late 70s. But you know, seeing Eddie Van Halen on stage was a huge inspiration.
And what was the venue?
It would have been in Baltimore where I was, in high school. Yeah. I can't remember what venue it was.
And the last concert you went to or the most recent one?
Oh, most recent. What was the most recent concert? Good question. I think it was probably Sophie Tucker, which is a duo, a team that Sophie and Tucker came out of Brown University and sort of electronic music duo.
My first one, my parents took me Maple Leaf Gardens, 1976, Neil Diamond. So I'm not sure if that, maybe in a few years that'll be a little bit cooler. But the first one that I went to on my own would have been, I think it was 82, and it was The Who.
Oh, very fun.
But it was the first tour after Keith had died.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. If you were on a desert island, three albums, not songs, three albums you would take.
Oh, well, you know, I guess it would have to be the first Van Halen album because that was...
How can you not?
Yeah, that was so inspirational to me. You mentioned, you know, I think Neil Diamond, Hot August Nights, is a great compilation of his music. I learned to play guitar to Neil Diamond songs.
Really?
So yes, yes, that's how I learned.
Which was there one in particular?
Oh God, I think I probably, because you know I had a brother-in-law who was a musician who taught me, and he played a lot of Neil Diamond songs. So that's how I first learned. So I probably over the years learned 25 Neil Diamond songs.
And they do stand the test of time.
Yeah,
they are good.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, and the third album,
Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I agree 100% with that. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.